From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the author of a new novel that our book critic Maureen Corrigan raved about. We meet Nuala O'Fuaillon. She's a columnist for the Irish Times and author of the best-selling memoir, Are You Somebody? Her new novel, My Dream of You, is about passion at middle age and also explores the roots of misogyny and sexual repression in Ireland. The story follows an Irish travel writer based in London who has a midlife crisis, quits her job, and returns to Ireland to research an obscure 18th century divorce scandal that offers clues to her country's history and to her own malaise. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Paul Brown. The Senate has approved landmark campaign reform legislation designed to reduce the influence of big money in political campaigns. The bill passed 59-41, capping a six-year struggle that catapulted Arizona Republican Senator John McCain to national prominence. A tough fight over the bill is expected in the House of Representatives, even though the House has approved similar bills twice in recent years. President Bush has not said whether he'll sign the bill. Even if he does, Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky promises to contest it in court as an infringement on free speech. President Bush is demanding that the Chinese government give the U.S. official access to the crew of an American surveillance plane that landed in China over the weekend. The plane had to land after being damaged in a mid-air collision with a Chinese fighter plane. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
The White House says the U.S. Navy plane was in international airspace when it collided with the Chinese fighter jet. It landed safely and all 24 crew members are okay, but the U.S. has since had no contact with the crew. Outside the Oval Office today, President Bush said the U.S. has been in contact with the Chinese government.
Our embassy officials are on the ground and prepared to visit the crew and aircraft as soon as the Chinese government allows them to do so. And I call on the Chinese government to grant this access promptly.
But the president said he's troubled by the lack of a timely response to that request so far, adding that failure to react properly is inconsistent with standard diplomatic practice and with both countries' stated desire to improve relations. Don Gagne, NPR News, The White House.
The head of the AFL-CIO, John Sweeney, has panned President Bush's $1.6 trillion tax cut plan. Sweeney says it's evidence of what he calls Mr. Bush's twisted priorities. NPR's Craig Windham reports.
Sweeney said the tax cut plan will force middle-class taxpayers to pick up the tab for years, while wealthy Americans reap the biggest benefits. Sweeney said his fear is that Mr. Bush will ignore the needs of people who make daily decisions between pork chops and peanut butter, while paying attention only to those who must decide between $125 and $190 bottles of Bordeaux wine. Sweeney was speaking in Washington to a legislative conference of the AFL-CIO's Building and Construction Trades Department, which represents 15 unions in the construction industry. As for the overall economy, Sweeney called on Mr. Bush to stop feeding fears of a recession and instead focus on trying to convince the Federal Reserve to keep lowering interest rates. Craig Windham, NPR News, Washington.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed down by 100.8 points today to end at 9777.9. Decliners led advancers 3-2 in heavy trading of over a billion shares. The Nasdaq Composite was down 57 at 1782.88. This is NPR News. A team of planetary scientists in Arizona is questioning claims that water carved a series of gullies seen near the poles of Mars. NPR's Joe Palca has more.
Water is a key to life, so scientists have been keen to find evidence of water on other planets. Last June, two researchers proposed that channels carved into the Martian surface were probably created by liquid water. The water, they argued, was trapped below the surface and occasionally bubbled out, eroding the rocks above. Now, researchers at the Lunar and Planetary Laboratory of the University of Arizona in Tucson are proposing a totally different geologic process to explain the same surface features. The Arizona scientists say liquid carbon dioxide, not liquid water, carved the gullies. Although carbon dioxide typically goes from a solid directly to a gas, when there is high pressure, CO2 can also be a liquid, and those conditions existed in the regions where the gullies appear. The new research is in the current issue of Geophysical Review Letters. Joe Palca, NPR News, Washington.
The Israeli army says heavy fighting erupted between Israeli soldiers and Palestinian gunmen today after an Israeli soldier was shot dead in Bethlehem. Israeli officials say the soldier was shot by a Palestinian sniper. The shooting raises the death toll in 7 months of violence to at least 367 Palestinians, 71 Israelis, and 13 Israeli Arabs. Two bodies have been found in the area where a fishing vessel disappeared with 15 people on board in the Bering Sea off the Alaskan coast. The Arctic Rose emitted an emergency locator beacon early this morning. The Coast Guard sent a plane to the area. Crews found the two bodies, but no sign of the boat. Paul Brown, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo Marriott Services and its employees, helping the hungry through the Sodexo Servathon, on the web at sodexomarriott.com.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from Saab, with safety features including the active head restraint, front and side airbags, and OnStar, all standard equipment. Information available at saabusa.com. And from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In her best-selling memoir, Are You Somebody?, Nuala O'Fuaillon, a columnist for the Irish Times, wrote about growing up one of nine children in Ireland, a nobody who came from a line of nobodies in a conservative Catholic country that feared sexuality. A New York Times Sunday Book Review described the memoir as having a spiky, independent intelligence that vanquishes cliché. Now O'Fuaillon has written her first novel, and it too has become a bestseller. It's the story of a middle-aged Irish woman who escaped the conditions of Ireland years ago by emigrating to England, where she writes for a travel magazine. After the death of her best friend, she has a midlife crisis, quits her job, and returns to Ireland to research an obscure 19th-century divorce scandal known as the Talbot Case. It helps her understand her country's sexual repression and misogyny, as well as her own malaise. Here's a brief reading.
I was interested always in any story about passion. I believed in passion the way other people believed in God. Everything fell into place around it. Even before I started mooching around after boys when I was 14, I'd understood, watching my mother, that passion was the name of the thing she was pursuing as she trawled through novel after novel.
Now, your character believes in passion. She's also middle-aged, and a lot of people assume that passion is supposed to burn less hot in middle age. Do you believe that the nature of passion changes?
Oh, yes, of course. Well, where it sits in your heart and your mind change. Because simply, how can it still be appropriate at, say, 54 to be running after the dream that you ran after when you were 14? How can you go on believing, and yet one does, how can you go on believing that somewhere in the world there's the other, the perfect person, the one who will understand you and cherish you and you will be as good back? How can you believe that that'll happen and it'll solve everything when, for one thing, when you're middle-aged, you have a history that you can never share. No matter how hard you try, it isn't there to be given. You can never describe it. And so you're already late to the table of perfect passion.
That's an interesting way of putting it. How does that apply to you as someone who's middle-aged?
Well, what I resent now is that I can't get rid of it. I can't get rid of the hope of something wonderful happening. And even at this late stage, having somebody who worries about me because I have to go to the dentist, or who wants to talk to me about our plans for the summer holidays, I would like to forget all that. And I'd like to forget how much my body would like to have had more use. I would like to be rid of all that because I feel demeaned a bit by still secretly longing for it. I'm getting better and better as I get older at all the other things, which is the great discovery of middle age. I never knew till a few years ago what animals can do. I had never had a dog or a cat before, and I hadn't realised that's a whole new kind of joy. And I hadn't realised either that you can make new friends in middle age. And I hadn't realised that you feel terribly well. I feel terrifically healthy, mentally and physically. So all kinds of things are kicking in. And if only I could stop wanting the impossible, I'd be as happy as a lark, Derek.
And
you see, who planted the seed of that impossible dream? It makes sense when you're young and you're looking for someone to mate with and build a nest with. But by my age, we have our nests and there won't be any children. So why is it just as... why does it pick at you and pull at you just as badly?
Well, what do you think? Do you think it's because it's a natural thing to yearn for that, or do you think it's the influence of novels and movies and fantasies?
I think it's cultural. I mean, for most of human history, and I think on most parts of the planet, there hasn't been this primacy of romantic love. But after all, I belong to my culture and I've been soaked in it since I can remember. And you know, the thing is this. The reason why there's a huge romance industry of songs and movies and dressing to attract and all that is because, on the whole, most people's lives are not very celebrated. And that first time when you're in love and the other person loves you too, you feel wonderful, you feel potent. Because you are loved, you feel you can talk about yourself and be listened to. And you listen to in a way that you never listen to your parents or your friends. And it's the preciousness of that experience that makes the dream of love so important. It's not just a trivial thing, and it's not just about the sensation of sex. It's about feeling that you are your whole, full self.
Although your main character is someone who really believes in passion, it's something she hasn't really been letting into her life at the beginning of the novel. But a friend and colleague of hers, a very close friend, dies suddenly of a heart attack, and that seems to be the impetus that shakes up her life and makes her go in search of things, including passion.
I don't think she knows that she's going in search of passion.
True.
But when we meet her, she's just 50. She's an Irish woman, a tall, stylish Irish woman with wonderful clothes, but they... mystery is that she hasn't been back to Ireland for 30 years. She lives in a basement apartment in London, even though she feels that the English are condescending to her in various ways. And she's a travel writer. She travels all the time. And it's true that no matter what high-flown things she may believe about passion, in practice, what it has boiled down to is affectless one-night stands in various far-flung hotels. In other words, she realises at the beginning of the novel she's got it wrong. She's got her life wrong. It's been on hold, but she doesn't know anymore for what. And then her dear friend Jimmy, who's a gay American from Scottsbluff, Nebraska, and also a travel writer, he dies unexpectedly. And he has been her partner insofar as she had one, and her family. He and the others in the office have been her family because she hasn't been home for 30 years. And what with that, what with Jimmy dying, and what with her beginning to see that maybe there's been one night stand too many, and also with her beginning to mistrust the kind of cheery travel writing she does, because she can't help but see that large parts of the world are very unjust and there's so much suffering that really writing tourist articles isn't you know, isn't adequate. All those things come together and they all impel her to change. And the only idea she has is to go back to Ireland to see could she maybe write a book about the Talbot divorce.
Your character thinks sometimes about what it means to, at her age, be not married and to not have children. I'm wondering how it feels to you to be not married and to not have children compared to how you thought it would feel when you were a young woman.
Well, I have never been bothered about married, being married or not married. I can't get over the way in America everybody seems to get married young. I think it's a very odd thing to do. I was often asked, and even one week I had the engagement ring. We were to get married on the Saturday and we decided on the Thursday not to get married. And we went on our honeymoon anyway, but we didn't go to the wedding. And sometimes I bump into people all these years later who say, where were you on your wedding day? We were there. Where were you? But I don't care that I've never been married and that I'm sure I'll never marry. But about being childless, quite apart from how much I love the sight and sound and being of children, and I do, I think that you have to ask yourself, what were you for, in a different way from most people. Most people solve the problem of their own meaning by having children, because then they have now invented a meaning for themselves. Their meaning now, having created children or helped to create children, is to rear those children with as much goodness and intelligence as they can, and to love them always and be loved by them. And so they slide through life belonging to life. And the times of life are appropriate when they're young. The hormones drive them and they make the children in their prime. They protect the children. And then when they're older, they become grandparents and give what they have to the grandchildren. And if you're childless, you're outside that beautiful movement of the generations. And it seems to me that you're far more self-conscious if you're childless. It seems to me that you have to, a woman certainly has to ask herself, well, what was it all about, all the fallings in love and the being mad about people and the choosing my clothes and having periods for 35 years? You know, what was it all for?
Do you feel like you've had to consciously go about constructing a meaning in your life?
I do, and I think that's what I did, quite not knowing that that's what I was doing. When I wrote my memoir, which, of course, never was a memoir. Nobody ever asked for it and nobody knew I was doing it. It was only an introduction to a book of old opinion columns. But I was in my early 50s and I couldn't understand why my life had come to so little and how I'd managed to end up with no partner, no gang of friends, no lover, no children, no money, no particular future to look forward to. And a desire to sort of write in some way to myself about what, looking back, had been the passion that brought me to this. I think I wouldn't have had to do it if I were a mother and a grandmother.
I think I should probably not ask you what meaning you were able to find in your life, because that would be asking you to reduce your life to a little statement here.
It doesn't work like that. You don't find a meaning. You don't at all find a meaning. I still know nothing. And I'm still, fundamentally as solitary as I was then. Mm-hmm. The difference is that I have had a small effect on other people. I know, because I got thousands and thousands of letters about the memoir from other members of the human race about their experience of being human. And I know that in some extraordinary way that managed to leap across culture and gender and age. The way I spoke to myself in desperation at my kitchen table in Dublin, Ireland, when I was 54, that somehow was heard by other people.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Nuala O'Fuaillon, and she has a new novel, which is called My Dream of You, and it's a follow-up to her best-selling memoir, Are You Somebody? Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. We hope that you've discovered books that you've enjoyed by listening to Fresh Air, and we hope that you've heard some of your favorite authors interviewed on the show. Our program, like everything else on public radio, requires your support in order to keep going. So please, call with a pledge. Thank you. My guest is Nuala O'Fuaillon. She's a columnist for the Irish Times. Her new novel is called My Dream of You. Now, your mother had 9 children, and she actually had 13 pregnancies. Mm. What impressions did it give you of motherhood, watching your mother raising 9 children?
As best she could, she didn't raise them. She very much resented being stuck in the country in a house with no hot water, with a husband who was gallivanting round in town, with all these children. It wasn't an occupation that gave her pleasure. And, you know, I think there's a lot more women than my mother who really get stuck with motherhood when it's not suitable to them. She would have been a great librarian. She would have been a wonderful wife and consort to him if children and poverty hadn't dragged her down.
You go ahead.
Just the other day, a woman showed me how to put combs in your hair. You know, if you kind of pull your hair back at the side and you want to pin it up.
Right.
And it occurred to me, Mammy never showed us anything. We didn't know anything about how you did things, the little things that parents tell a child. My parents didn't tell any of us. I remember one of my sisters, who's now very troubled, saying to me, that woman never said one useful thing to me in my life. And just the combs reminded me that I never knew anything when I grew up.
You're the second oldest of the 9 children. So when you were growing up, was your mother pregnant most of the time?
She was, yeah.
What did it make you think of pregnancy, watching her be pregnant?
It never made me think anything. Everybody, all the women around were always pregnant. Everyone was pregnant all the time. I know that women seemed to me to be, well, they were effectively a second rate, a race of second rate people in the Ireland I grew up in. There, not only was there no contraception available, unless there was the rhythm method that my mother and the other women in the country had never heard of, and which they could never have enforced on their men anyway. But not only was there no family planning when I was an adult woman, but you weren't even allowed to know that it existed. So when I was an adult woman, and all my sisters along with me, there were men in the Irish Customs Force pulling out the back pages of American and British magazines so that Irish women wouldn't have access to little ads about clinics where you could send away for books. We were supposed not even to know. And that was the condition that Irish women were pushed to by the combination of the native patriarchy and the Roman Catholic Church.
How did you discover birth control?
Well, we heard of it. We heard of it. And, of course, in the 60s, from America, where in my life all good things have come from for us in Ireland. Well, no, but half of the good things, the pill was rumoured to exist. And it was forbidden in Ireland for many, many years. But it's now more or less widely available. You're supposed to be married to get it.
If you don't mind my asking, were you able to discover birth control at the same time you discovered sex?
No, I took the most hideous risks. I have, in fact, never used any birth control, but it became evident to me in my 20s that I must be infertile. And I think I was. I did get pregnant when I was 39, but I had a miscarriage.
Oh. Were you sorry?
I was too confused to know what I felt.
You must have been stunned to be pregnant in the first place.
Utterly stunned. It was dreadful. And I couldn't possibly make any kind of decision. So now, I don't know. Now I could be a good mother, but what good is that in your 50s? You know, you need, I think, tremendous physical strength to be a terrific mother.
Now, you must have functioned almost like a mother when you were growing up because you were the second oldest of 9 children. Your mother wasn't very effective as a mother. So imagine that you and your older sibling took over some of the responsibility.
Yeah, but grudgingly. I mean, this is how Dickens tells lies about how happy big families are. Big families are happy if there are enough resources of love and intelligence and enough material resources. But we were just left to scrabble our way up as best we could. And I can never remember without pain that my elder sister used to try to keep one blouse clean. She'd keep it washed and ironed, and she'd hide it in different parts of the house because all the other girls would be trying to steal her blouse because the clothes were always in chaos, you know, jumbled up together in one big cupboard. Because poor mummy, she was forever doing washes, but, you know, you need a certain base of efficiency to run a family. There used to be a book by some American, I think it was called Cheaper by the Dozen. I used to adore that book when I was a child because it was about a very large family, but run by loving parents on rational principles. If you see what I mean.
Yeah.
Instead of the chaos and neglect in our house and how we had to strive against each other for the means of survival.
So you became a resentful parental figure in your house because you were one of the oldest.
Oh, I wouldn't say. We didn't think in terms like that. I did what I had to. But I, like all the others, I got out as soon as I possibly could.
How'd you get out?
I moved into town. I got a job in a shop. I got a scholarship to the university. When I lost the scholarship, I got more jobs. And I went off on my own rocky, chaotic road. And I left them at home to sink or swim. And just over half of the family, I would say, are well. And the other half are struggling. And one killed himself.
A brother killed himself.
Yeah.
Nuala Ofuelon, she's the author of the new novel, My Dream of You. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with best-selling Irish writer Nuala Ofuelon. We'll talk about her father, one of Ireland's first society columnists. Ofuelon's new novel is called My Dream of You.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Random House Incorporated's Bantam Books Division, publisher of Folly, a novel by Laurie R. King, the author of A Darker Place. And from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to our interview with Nuala O'Fuaillon. She's a columnist for the Irish Times and author of the new best-selling novel, My Dream of You. Her previous book was the best-selling memoir, Are You Somebody?, which was about growing up one of nine children in a poor and sexually repressed country. Now, let me back up a little bit. You were sent to, I think, a convent boarding school when you were about 14. And you say, yes. you say that... Puberty got you into a lot of trouble and that you were stunned by the demands of the body that you had barely noticed before. What kind of things got you into trouble?
Dancing. There used to be dances in the little town we lived in. They started at 10 at night and went on till 4 in the morning. I need hardly tell you that I was a schoolgirl at the convent, a day school, and it was utterly unheard of for schoolgirls to go to these dances. These dances were essentially for the working class to find each other. But I went. I used to steal the money from my poor mother to go. And I'd be locked in and I'd find some other way to get out. And I'd be locked in again and I'd find some other way. And so on and so on. And one Friday, the nuns in the convent managed to track down my father and said to him, we want you to take her away. And it was a real crisis. Now, there were crises occurred all the time in our family, and other people's crises went unmanaged. But for some reason, they went to great trouble for me. By their standards, they went to great trouble for me. My father had a small car, and he sold it and bought me the clothes to go to boarding school, because you had to have a trunk, you know. You had to have things like three night dresses and two pairs of shoes and so on. And we'd always only ever had one of anything at the most. You know, one of anything. So I was sent off to a boarding school, an Irish-speaking boarding school up on the border with Northern Ireland. I arrived there the day I was 14 and I didn't get out till I was 17 and a half. And I didn't fit in very well. But it was, like many of those old-fashioned Irish boarding schools, a very, very good education. The things I learnt there, and I mean strictly learning, you know, like poetry or geography or anything, you don't forget that stuff, not when the nuns have slammed it into you, so to speak.
Did you like having the structured environment of the convent, or was it just too repressive for you?
I just wanted to get back to dances. I wanted to, I don't know the American for courting, snugging, whatever. That's what I wanted. I wanted to work in a shop like my friends in Dublin. And I wanted to go to dances and I wanted to be left home by good-looking boys. And I was lost in that stuff. And by accident, on the side, I was very good at school. And by accident, you know, I got scholarships and so on and firsts in Ireland and everything. But I didn't care about that. I wanted the security of physical love.
Now, your father was a society columnist. What kind of stories did he cover?
Well, the car would call for him at 3 in the afternoon, a limo with the driver, with the cap, and my father would emerge spotless in his evening dress. He was a most impeccable and fastidious little man, and, you know, the house would be in uproar, maybe. And Mammy might have been drinking at lunchtime and we might be looking for money or something. But Daddy went to work. His correspondence would have been opened by his secretary, and as he was driven into Dublin, he'd make a list of the four or five things he'd go to that night. He might go to the launch of some product. He might go to the opening of a ballet season. He might go to a party for a political retiree. Whatever constituted the growing sort of PR world of Dublin. He was the first ever. And then at midnight, he went to his office and he wrote 2,000 words every single night. about these things he'd been at, and the photographer contributed the photos. You know, the way there were always photos of pretty young women, you know, seen last night at such mm-hmm. and such. And the thing came out the next day. And sometimes there'd be something that moved him much more deeply, and then he mightn't go and do his stuff. He would just write a column. I remember when President Kennedy was shot, he wrote a marvellously sincere and affecting column. And I know when he visited the Sinai Desert, he wrote about that. When the Pope, John the 23rd at the time, went to the River Jordan, he went there too and wrote about that. So I think he was probably a lovely writer who was very much underappreciated from that point of view.
Now, how could it be that you and your sisters and brothers hardly had any clothes, and your father had this fantastic evening wear that he'd go off in every night? I mean, how is it that
he was
living in the
keeping...
society world and you and your family had nothing?
Oh, well, we didn't have nothing. We had just enough. The thing is, he was keeping the show going. I think he must have thought in his own mind that there was nothing he could do by joining us in our chaos, you know. He would have had to be a saint to both do his job and care for us. He was an old-fashioned man of old-fashioned people. It was Mammy's job to look after us. It was his job to bring home the money. And he did bring home the money, but he had to spend a good bit of that money on himself, because he couldn't go about his job in shabby clothes or anything. You know, he had to have the money for dry cleaning and so on. But, I mean, I have to stress that he loved us, and we loved him.
Did you want to be in that world that he was writing about, that society world?
No. I thought nothing of it. I moved in and out of it with the Grace DeVries. I occasionally wrote his column, actually.
Did you really?
Yeah, nobody would realise it, but I could. He had great faith in me on that level. He ran a music festival for a while in Dublin. He loved classical music, you know, and he got people to come over. I remember Isaac Stern came, and while he was doing that, I wrote his column. But, you know, the Irish are not class-bound the way the English are. It's our country, you know. To this day, if I want to go and see the president, or if I want to join in someone's wedding, or if I want to go to a dinner party, I simply ask around till I fix it up. There's no barriers. There'd be very few worlds in Ireland that I wouldn't feel completely, perfectly, naturally at home in. I think the only one is the one that the Talbots were part of. There's still an Anglo-Irish gentry who I think consider themselves a cut above the Catholic Irish. And I don't know any of them, hardly. I know a few of them, but I don't get asked to their dinner parties, and indeed I don't want to go.
My guest is Nuala O'Fuilon. Her new novel is called My Dream of You. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is writer Nuala O'Fuilon, and her new novel is called My Dream of You. Her best-selling memoir is called Are You Somebody? Now, you've said that depression runs in your family, and you mentioned before that several members of your family have serious trouble. One of your brothers committed suicide. Was there not quite a word for depression in your parents' day?
No, and I don't think there were any antidepressants. It's not depression anyway. It's despair.
What's the difference to you?
Well, there's something dramatically suffering in those of my brothers and sisters who are suffering. It's not a dull thing they live with. It's a thing that keeps attacking them and trying to drag them down. And it took me a long time to defeat the demons who were trying to drag me down. And I really only did it in middle age. And I wish I'd managed to do it when I was younger so that I wouldn't have wasted my whole 30s in drinking and so on.
Did you drink a lot in your 30s?
Yes. I was an alcoholic, by the end of my 30s. And there, the year I was 40, I was in a psychiatric hospital for a while. But then, luckily, I was completely derelict, really, mentally and emotionally. Luckily, I fell in love with a gay woman. And this was after a lifetime of being mad about various men. And we lived together for 14 years. And it was immensely healing to live with a woman.
In what ways was that healing?
We had a home. I don't know how to explain to you, but I had a domestic life for the first time ever. I loved it. I loved buying cups and buying an egg lifter. And I just loved it. There's an intrinsic tension, I think, between men and women. And it wasn't there between myself and my friend. It's true that the relationship didn't last, but I've had such great strokes of luck in my life, like being sent off to boarding school, and like that one, that she cared about me and stuck with me while I finally sort of kicked sleeping tablets and then cut back and back and back on the drink. If anything, then I became happier and healthier than she. And anyway, we broke up, and a year after I wrote the memoir.
Were you surprised falling in love with a woman?
I was when I came to think of it. But when it actually happened, my whole world was so disoriented because my father had died slowly and very, very savagely. And I'd been drinking and I hadn't slept for 6 months or something, and I could barely hang on to my job, and I weighed 56 pounds less than I weigh today. And I don't think I was at all well mentally. So I was free. I was free of every constraint. I didn't know. It never really dawned on me that she was a woman for a while, you know. I mean, of course, I know she was a woman, but the strangeness of it didn't strike me for a long time.
What did your father die of?
He died of a mixture of leukemia and cirrhosis of the liver.
Oof. Did he have chemo?
And yeah, it's that he'd say in hospital, take me out of here, take me out.
Did your family take him out?
No. No.
Did you think?
He didn't know how to. And I must say, it's the first thing he ever asked of any of us. Anyway, he died after 6 months, 21 years ago. Gosh. And my mother hung on for a few years. And she'd say to me, Nuala, why did your father go and die and leave me here? You know, and she'd be real petulant about it. Because the funny thing was, she was his kind of girlfriend up to the end. They were very aware of each other. She kept that thing going, you know, in spite of everything. She kept the passion going. And she'd say to me, you know, Nuala, your father and I were very close, and I mean very close. And you see, she was a decorous woman, prudish, you know, but she was indicating to me that they made love, you see, until he was 66 or something. And she said, and then, you know, Nuala, he'd say to me, I'm sorry, Catherine. I'm sorry, darling. I'm a bit tired. And she was boasting to me, you see, that she had been a desired woman by him, and he was all she ever cared about.
You are living part of the time in New York now.
Well, I have been. I hope to. I'm not at the moment. I'm going home to Ireland.
You don't divide your time between New York and Ireland?
No, I haven't yet set that up.
Oh, I thought that already happened. I see. Okay.
No. To write the novel, I moved to Manhattan and got a room because I wanted to borrow the energy and optimism of a great immigrant city, you know, full of people transforming themselves and trying to do things they'd never done before. And it worked. It helped enormously in writing the novel. But now I'm at a loss. The novel's finished. It's out. This is the very end of the publicity I've done for it. I'm going back to Ireland in 2 days. And I don't know where I am, Terry. I do not know where I am in life or what has happened. I'm going back to the same situation I was in 5 years ago before I wrote the memoir. I'm a woman getting older. I'm on my own, except for my little dog, who I love. And I have to come to some terms with it and make some arrangements and live the precious life I have left as well as I can.
Let me ask you, since I know one of the things you're thinking about is, you know, the process of getting older.
Mm-hmm.
It's I think, always been assumed that you get older, you have children who help take care of you, you have a spouse, if they're still living, who helps take care of you. But a lot of people now aren't married, they're not in a long-term relationship, they don't have children, they're not going to have children, and they're going to be getting older. So the kind of system of how you get by when you get older is going to have to change, because the whole nature of family life for a lot of people has changed.
Yes.
Do you think about that a lot?
I do. I do indeed. And my only motivation for wanting to earn money is for the nursing home at the end. But, of course, you don't know how long you might be infirm. I mean, I have an auntie of 87, and, I mean, she's in perfect physical nick. It might be another 10 years, you know. And you need money. You need money. That's what you need. If you've money, you can more or less face real old age. But besides money, what you need, and perhaps this would get you through even if you didn't have any money, you need an attitude to aging that allows you not to regret and not to repine, but to take vitality from the small things of the everyday. And I'm getting better and better at that stuff. First of all, as I say, I discovered animals, small little animals, you know, the company of them. I think food and a moderate amount of drink are great resources as you get older, because if your body's getting all wrinkly and saggy and so on, I really do think that you might as well let go. I mean, I've never been on a diet, but at this stage, I'm not going to go on one either. I think that landscape matters an awful lot. Music means a great deal to me, and it does really. It's not a show-offy thing. It's from my heart for myself. And travel does, and I've a few friends. A lot of them made just recently, because there was a kind of burnt life left when I finished the long relationship with my friend Nell. So I'm saying that there are lots of things you can put in a palisade around you and plant like little seeds in your heart to sprout in your 60s and 70s and, please God, 80s. When really you can't be hanging around looking for just passion, to go back to the thing we began with.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Nuala O'Fuilon is the author of the new novel, My Dream of You. Her memoir is called Are You Somebody? This is Fresh Air. It's unusual to find a place on the radio where you can hear novelists and poets talking about their work. When you find it, you know it's public radio. Public radio is a special place for writers and for readers. That's just one of the many reasons it's worth supporting. Please call with your pledge. Thank you. The music of California-based composer, poet, and dancer Lou Harrison is probably better known on the West Coast than in the rest of the country. But, says music critic Lloyd Schwartz, choreographer Mark Morris has been trying to change that by bringing Harrison's music to a wider audience. Now a major composition of Harrison's, commissioned by Morris, has been released on CD. Here's Lloyd's review.
Live music is something I must have, choreographer Mark Morris told an audience at a Q&A session after a performance. And some of the greatest music of the past century, including Stravinsky's Firebird, Petrushka, and Rite of Spring, Prokofiev's Prodigal Son, and Hindemith's Four Temperaments, were composed for or commissioned by choreographers. One of the composers Mark Morris has championed is the now 83-year-old Californian Lou Harrison. When Mikhail Baryshnikov was a recipient of the Kennedy Center honors a few months ago, Morris's dance group did a writhing round dance to a Lou Harrison polka. Morris's most recent Harrison commission is Rhymes with Silver, which premiered in 1997 in Berkeley. This chamber piece for string trio, piano, and percussion is a major work, nearly 50 minutes of extremely colorful and appealing music for the dance floor, a cakewalk, a foxtrot, a waltz, alternating with folk music and evocations of Eastern ritual, gamelan-like gongs and chimes and vibes and exotic scales. This is typical both of Harrison's interests in non-Western cultures and the extreme physicality of his music. It insinuates itself into the body, makes muscles want to move. At the heart of Rhymes with Silver are a series of cello solos originally written for Yo-Yo Ma. Joan Jeanrenaud, the former cellist of the Kronos Quartet, is the cellist on the new CD released by the San Francisco-based New Albion Records. The most moving music is the sinuous prelude, written to be played before the curtain rises. Some of the music Harrison calls adjustable and can be rearranged at the discretion of the musicians. This recording uses sections arranged by Mark Morris himself. In one section, Morris, mime-like, gropes imaginary walls and races on and off stage in the presence of another dancer who remains absolutely motionless, Buddha-like. Morris calls this a pas de deux. Picture Morris jerking out his foot at the plucked note that ends each phrase. In another section, the dancers reflect the ups and downs of the cello with the old game of sewing up one's fingers. And it all ends with, what else? Another round dance. The title, Rhymes with Silver, by the way, refers to Harrison's name, Lou Silver Harrison. And what rhymes with silver? Nothing. Harrison is a refreshing change from the intellectualization behind a lot of contemporary concert music. I dare you to sit still while you're listening. It's not only accessible, it gives accessibility a good name.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix and author of a new book of poems called Cairo Traffic. He reviewed Rhymes with Silver by Lou Harrison. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today was Roberta Sherrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Monique Nazareth, with Megan Howell and Patty Leswing. Our researcher is Jessica Chu. Anne-Marie Baldonado directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, crossing Asia, following the path of a 7th century Buddhist monk who went in search of the ultimate truth. We talk with New York Times book critic Richard Bernstein about why he, a secular Jew, single, childless, and uneasy with the idea of home, made the journey. His new book is called Ultimate Journey. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.